the iPhone had come out, but the iPad hadn't come out yet. So these touchscreen devices for the first time, video being able to be played on mobile phones for the first time, we were just going, this is game changing. Like, you can actually watch video, television on your phone. What else can you do?
Hello, and welcome to a very special episode of The Entrepreneur Experiment with me, Gary Fox. So why is it special? We made it to episode 50. I'm absolutely thrilled to be able to say that. When I started off the podcast, I really had no idea we'd make it all the way to 50. So I want to thank you. Thank every single one of you who are listening, who make the show what it is. And thank you to all my guests who've been on the show over the last 12 months. People have been unbelievably willing to share their stories and their journey with me and just really open up and be honest about what it takes to start your own business. Without them, there would be no show. So thank every single one of them individually. And I really do appreciate their time and their effort to make The Entrepreneur Experiment what it has been over the last year. The episode is now also available on YouTube. You can go back and look at past episodes, which will be going up in the next couple of weeks. But every episode goes live now on Thursday, along with the audio version. So you can head over there and watch video versions of the pod. Just search The Entrepreneur Experiment in YouTube, or you can head over and look at it from my website. Just make sure to subscribe, and then you'll be able to watch the episodes as they go up on a Thursday. And down the line, we're also going to look at doing some live streaming of some episodes as well. So make sure you're subscribed to that. I'm also going to go ahead and launch the private community I talked about in the last couple of episodes. That'll be somewhere for listeners and guests of the show to meet in a more kind of organized way, I guess. So they'll be able to share ideas, get feedback, you know, share tips, share stories, and just have a community where we can all be together and engage in a more deeper level. So that'll be going live in the next month. The only way to become a member of that is to join my mailing list. So go over to mrgaryfox.com, join the mailing list, and you'll then be on the shortlist to join the private community, which will launch in a couple of weeks. So head over there and do that today. In the meantime, here is episode 50 with Claire McHugh from Accionista. Claire, welcome to the pod.
Thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome.
How are you?
I'm good. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. It is distinguishable from any other day.
I'm glad you told me because I didn't know.
Yeah, it's always good to celebrate the little things. And Friday's got a nice ring to it.
I agree. Yeah, you got to celebrate the little things. Absolutely. So give a little bit of context of where you are, I guess, because who knows when someone will be listening to this, maybe 2 years in the future when someone's listening back, they'll be like wondering where we were.
Wow. I'm just actually thinking of what 2 years in the future might actually even look like.
Yeah, we were having a little chat off camera, so feel free to take me there if you want.
Yeah, no. I mean, let's not go too far into the distant
we'll
future.
We'll ease ourselves into it. We might come to that at the end.
Yeah.
So you're at home.
I am at home. I am in what I call my office, which is really the back bedroom of our apartment. But this is where I go to work every day now.
Okay. At least you have somewhere. You know, we were talking about that earlier. It's kind of nice to have somewhere specific, and it's like me where I am in the little office. It's nice to have somewhere you go in and that's your little space. So how have things, we won't touch on COVID too much, but obviously it's the elephant in the room at the minute, but we'll mainly just talk about your story and where you guys have come from. But maybe just talk a little bit about the first kind of couple of weeks, the last couple of weeks, I suppose, first, and we'll kind of get that out of the way, and then we'll jump back to like 10 years ago.
Yeah, we were talking earlier about like structure and habits and how, like, for me that plays an enormous part of keeping normality in a way. So like I actually make myself a coffee, go out for a walk, I walk to work, and then I come back in a little bit more awake, and I go into this room, and this is where I work all day, and I do all my calls from here. And like I could be on the phone or on Zoom calls pretty much for a good chunk of the day, but I close the door on this and then I leave, and then I'm at home after that. So for me, that's a very important structure. And also in the evenings, I would do yoga or another form of exercise as well, because if I don't do that, then who knows what happens. So it's very, very important for me to actually keep as much normality as possible into my own sort of schedule. I think that helps me then bring a sense of normality to the rest of the team in a way. So that, you know, I'm not operating much more differently than I would have been if they were working with me in normal circumstances. And I found personally the last few weeks to have gone incredibly fast. Like, I think we're just lashing through the days. It's like Friday today, but it felt like it was Monday yesterday.
That's interesting. Because,
yeah. I think it's just, we've been really busy. So our team, we're 50% remote before this started. Now everybody's working from home, obviously, for the last 5 or 6 weeks, I'm going
to
say.
I've lost count. I was trying to remember with someone yesterday. I was like, is this week 8, 7, 6?
You know, I remember when we had an all hands about it. It was the day that, you know what, the Monday of that week where we all started working from home, we were at our senior leaders team meeting on the Monday afternoon going, we should probably do a drill where we all work from home for like a couple of days or maybe even a week. And that was the Monday. We're like, yeah, let's do that 2 weeks from now as a trial to see how it goes. Because we had like a pandemic procedure and we had all that stuff
really
prepared. Yeah, we did, yeah.
Way back? Or is this something you kind of saw January, February coming down the tracks and you're like, oh, we might need to do something?
So we're high on process and documenting process because we have a lot of enterprise customers, and in order to become a vendor, you need to be very high on your security and, you know, what happens and backup plans and, you know, all of the contingency business plans that you have before they will take you on as a vendor, because they want you to have demonstrated that you've thought about those things. So we do have those type of things in place.
That's super interesting.
But we didn't think we'd have to roll it out.
That's so interesting though. I didn't even think that'd be a thing. I was talking to a friend of mine, he works with a lot of insurance clients, and he was talking about Wimbledon's pandemic insurance. But that was the first time I'd ever heard about someone thinking about it specifically. But so you guys already had that in place. That's really interesting. That was a result of dealing with big clients.
It is, yeah, because you have to think about all the different things that could possibly go wrong and the scenarios where the office might be closed, that type of thing, and security of information and all of the different things that go along with that. So, and we have somebody on our team who's particularly strong on that stuff, and she's our director of engineering, so a lot of it's technical. But so that was the Monday. And then on the Thursday, I think Leo Bradker had that. He was in New York, I think, and he was like,
yes,
everyone must go home now.
Paddy's week, actually. Yeah, Paddy's week, yeah.
Yes. And I remember then that day going, holy shit, this is actually happening. And I was in shock personally. And I remember going, I had to deliver an all hands. I told everybody that we were going home because there was a pandemic. And it was the weirdest moment of my CEO life to sit there with everybody in the company. So there's less than 30 of us, but around that, like, and some of them are in different countries. So we, you know, we're in Croatia, a good few of us in Croatia, there's some of us in Spain, France, and the rest of us are in Ireland, mostly in Dublin, but also in Galway. And it was like, this is the most surreal thing I've ever had to do in my life. And I was hoping that nobody would notice that my hands were shaking slightly. My voice was fine, but yeah. I could tell that I was in shock. And it was just really, 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 really weird for everybody.
It's so cool to hear someone talk about that, because I think people don't really think about that leadership in a time of absolute crisis. Like, so it's refreshingly honest to hear someone talk about it, because I suppose, how could you practice? It's not like, you know, an investor deck where you've kind of run through it a million times. You have to go up and talk about a pandemic. You're like, what?
You can't, right? But what you can do is try and give people a sense of comfort, a sense of where they are, like, and I would do that every week. So we have an all hands every week where we just keep people up to date on what's going. In the first few weeks, it was really important to tell people what we were doing to ensure that the business was okay. Like, we didn't know. Yeah. Nobody knew what was going on. The first couple of weeks, it was like, well, how does this actually impact the world?
Yeah.
How does this impact our customers? How does this impact our suppliers? Well, you know, supply chain stuff. Because we're cloud-based and we're video software and we're in the media industry, we had a lot of tick boxes in our favor. Mm. You know, and I think that had we been focused on the travel sector or focused on sports, for example, things might be very, very different right now. But, you know, we did all of the things that we could do. We talked to everybody, talked to like our advisors, investors, everybody. And just, it was a kind of it was, I just remember something there, like, in terms of, I actually had to almost roll out the "what if Claire doesn't exist anymore" plan and tell people who are in that plan, well, hey, you know, course. If I am on an extended absence, you're now in charge of the company.
I didn't even think of that, actually. What happens in that case? And then if the person below you is out, what happens? And the person below them is out. Okay, wow.
So all that business continuity stuff, right? All that phone stuff. So that was the first couple of weeks where it was like, just tell people. Be honest about it. We don't really know how it's going to affect, but this is what we're doing about it. And this is, you know, and it was important for team morale, I think, to be as accessible as possible and as visible as possible, and also just as honest as we could possibly be. I think people appreciated that. And now it's kind of, it's been more of an exercise where the Dublin team has gained an enormous amount of empathy for our remote colleagues.
But it's amazing that you guys are already 50% remote. That's huge. That's really, really interesting. Was that a conscious choice, or was that something that just happened organically over time?
Now, originally it happened organically, and it was a result of a couple of factors that were changing in Dublin. So we had a very a team from lots of different countries working in Dublin. Everyone was in the one office, and then some of those people went home to their home country but said, hey, can I continue to work here? And we were like, yeah, how hard can that be? And we discovered it was pretty difficult, actually, from an operational point of view and stuff. So we were like, ooh, this is interesting. And one of the guys went back to Croatia, and then he, you know, we were coming up with other roles, and he was like, well, I have some friends who are pretty good in QA. And we ended up having a small Croatian bunch of people. We have a new person starting in Croatia on Monday.
No way. This Monday.
Yeah, this Monday. And it's in the same town that our QA team are in as well. So there's like the place in Croatia called Osijek, which is where our guys are. And it's so funny that, like, I now have two people on my team I have never met.
That's so interesting. That's such a modern company.
And one of the guys actually came to Dublin to work with us from Spain, and he's been in an Airbnb since he got here.
Oh, wow.
So I've never met him. I see him every morning at our coffee chat at 9:30. We all just, like, go on Zoom and just talk. We have a question, like Jenny, who's our company experience manager, will just come up with a theme, or we'll do a crossword, or we'll do some kind of math puzzle.
Oh, random.
You know, where we can all, like it's the theme du jour, and it's just about having that quality time with people. And I think that it came up in an all hands recently where, hey, can we keep that? Because we really like it.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it's like, yeah, actually we should. We should do this all the time.
Yeah, that's cool. I think we talked earlier about doing things that you never considered doing before, and suddenly things become the new norm.
Yeah.
So you all get on, you all just literally just I suppose it's like recreating kind of the canteen, I suppose. Would it be kind of recreating your kind of morning coffee, recreating kind of the office vibe, I suppose?
Yeah, I think it's that, but it's inclusive. It's so much more inclusive than coffee chats in the kitchen, because we have the remote team involved in it as well.
Yes.
And it's better.
What has blown me away is how quickly people have got on Zoom and got comfortable with being on camera, having headsets like this, you know, chatting away. I even would never have considered it before. I see all my pods face to face in a room, because I was like, oh no, it would never work. You know, just wouldn't get that vibe. You know, I'd feel uncomfortable. They'd feel uncomfortable. No, you know, and it's amazing because we had to, first week, no problem. Instantly.
Yeah.
I think because everyone, it's like you made a great point earlier about everyone's in it. Everyone's doing this together. Everyone's feeling the same pain. Everyone's feeling the same experience. So there was no kind of like cajoling people to go, oh, well, would you mind doing a remote podcast? Everyone's like, yeah, of course. That's what I do every day for like 5 hours.
Exactly. and that's incredibly interesting. And it must have been super, super weird to work for Zoom in the last 6 weeks. Like, you go from, I don't know how many daily active users they had before, but then it's like, oh, everyone on the planet is using our software for multiple different things we've never even considered. And, you know, that's a big shift to get used to. And you know, they've had their issues for sure along the way, but it seems like they're dealing with it quite well.
To be fair, I think the majority of companies would have just fallen over on their face. You know, the explosion, because it was one of those weird things. How do things spread? It's just Zoom. There was no other company in the conversation. We're doing a Zoom call.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, there was no other, oh, will we do YouTube Hangouts? Will you do Skype? Just Zoom. It does work very simply, very, very intuitively. It is a good thing. But like, imagine, like, it's funny, like there are companies who are doing really well out of this. And that's kind of an indicator of the new world as well. So what's kind of stood out for you guys over the last kind of couple of weeks? What's been happening kind of in the business?
Yeah, so like that, you know, in the last couple of weeks, we have a bit more time to really figure out where the short-term needs are and also where the longer-term behavioral changes are in the market. And for us, because we're in the video space, so our product is a video content management system. So it's cloud-based. So if you're working from, like all our customers are working from home, they're using our product in their home because you know, it's on the cloud, which is great, you know. But also it's about creating streaming services with Shoppable. So we have video, we have e-commerce, we have a lot of things that are very, very useful for people who can't do business the way that they used to do business. So we're seeing a lot of inbound requests from types of businesses that maybe wouldn't have come across us before. So it's been very, very interesting to us from a, you know, a longer term view. And some people, when they talk to us, say, you know what, this was in our plan. We wanted to launch a video series and we just haven't got around to it quite yet. Or, you know, we'd like to launch an OTT service and this seems like a good opportunity to start planning it. You know, so there's a lot of people who are, it was, you know, they got a bit of time to actually go and do something that they'd already planned to do. Or there were people who were going, crap, we usually do live events. We can't do them anymore. Can we do something that's like a, you know, that has e-commerce and it's a live stream? And I was like, yeah, we can. We do that for QVC worldwide. So yes,
oh, well.
So that's something that we could do.
Maybe for people who have no idea what you guys do, maybe just explain it really simply for people.
So essentially we have a video content management system for streaming apps that are like uniquely what makes them great is that they can be shoppable and interactive. So you can launch a video service on any sort of living room device. So like Roku boxes, Apple TVs, Fire TVs, those type of things.
Okay.
It's kind of like So like a streaming service or a video on demand, that's what you make with our product. And our product's like the content management system behind that.
Okay.
But it allows you to do interactive call to actions on top of the video. So they're actually something that the viewer can interact with while they're watching the video. So if you're, say, for example, Gary Fox podcast video, if you had a video, you are a video right now to me, and someone was watching this video and there was a little pop-up call to action that was like, subscribe to my newsletter, they could really do that quite quickly while they're thinking of you.
Okay.
You know, and then it's like, while you have their attention, it's not a baked-in graphic, so it's an overlay on top of the screen that they could type into.
And how do they interact with that? How do they kind of go, okay, I'm going to subscribe to Gary's newsletter?
Little box will come up if they tap it and they put their name in, their email address in, and they go.
Very smart.
And that's it. And they're still watching the video.
Yeah. So you're not taking
call
them
out. Action complete.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah. You're not taking them away from it.
Mm.
So other things would be like, so we would have our typical customers would be either, like I mentioned with QVC, like shopping or so that, you know, they're actually showcasing the product and you can buy it at the same time. So it's like a buy button.
Yeah.
You know?
That's really cool.
But also they showcase other products that they would have sold earlier or, you know, things that might go along with that outfit or the thing that the presenter is wearing, that type of thing. Or more about the brand, you know, there's a blog post and there's stuff you can play with while you're still watching. And it just allows people to watch for longer, which, you know, technically then increases your chance of selling them more things.
Yeah, of course.
That news is another one as well. So news is very interactive. We do a lot of, there's a lot of local news broadcasters that use our software in the US. And it's towns in Ohio and places like that where, you know, it's very much local weather, local news guy. And it's really like what's super interesting to us about these guys is how they're adapting to having to suddenly shoot television from their homes. there's a whole other conversation there. But they're doing really, really good job. And it's also, you know, another customer of ours would be the Irish Film Institute, and they have this hugely rich historical archive of Irish film going back to the late 1800s. Like it's an enormous resource. And because our content management system comes with like these sort of like template apps, if you will, across all the ways, they can use those apps just to get to a global audience super quickly.
Okay.
With the collections of film that they have. So it's a really good educational resource right now for history, you know, school teachers who
of course like suddenly thinking of all the different ways remotely. This could be relevant now suddenly. So like take me back then to 2009, you might have had the idea, 2010.
So I was working at the Tant of Sports, and I was working there for about a year. And during that time, I got to really, because I was quite early on in when they hired early on when they actually started the TV side of things, I was working with them when they were kind of doing media things. So we were writing sports updates for Vodafone. Phone messages and SMS and stuff like that.
I remember all that. I remember Sedanta coming on and I was just trying to figure it out. Yeah. And then even that was very novel at the time.
It was incredibly novel. It was great crack. And then they hired a bunch of people from RTE Sport and they knew what they were doing because a lot of them had been working in TV for many, many years. So it was incredible learning experience about how companies start up, how companies operate, and also how the media world works, specifically sports media. But my job there, like, I had many because it was kind of like, hey, can you do that? Yeah, that sounds like fun. But the last bit I had was I was sort of coming up with the schedule. So like you had these live events and they were happening at those times. You could move them, but you could put shows before or after that would direct an audience. So you were trying to create an experience for that audience that would be like, okay, watching the show, will they stay around for this? Yes, let's put that on afterwards.
Cool. I always wonder how that worked, actually. Weirdly enough, I always look at the listings, especially for sports, like the matches and stuff. I'd be watching like a United City match at 4 and suddenly at 3 there's something else that hooks you in, and then afterwards there's something else hooks you in, and then it goes into Real Barca and you're like, oh yeah. So it's your little consumer behavior brain working behind it.
Yeah, and it was kind of like, if you look at how, like, for example, I really like Spotify as a company.
Yeah.
And how they do their Discover Weekly is so, it's kind of similar in a way. Like, there's like human curation going into that algorithm. Mm. You know, it's looking at other people who have similar tastes to you and funneling through different things that you might like. I'm just very interested in that sort of aspect of technology. But when I was at Satanta, streaming just really started to kick off in 2010. We had the iPhone had come out, but the iPad hadn't come out yet. So you touchscreen devices for the first time, video being able to be played on mobile phones for the first time. And it was myself and Dara, my co-founder, and we were just going, this is game changing. Like, you can actually watch video television on your phone and it's watchable. What else can you do? And you could touch your screen. Like, what are the possibilities of this? So we really found that Axonis on the vision of, you know, creating technology tools that would enable storytellers to still tell stories in new ways. And essentially that's still what we do. We just, you know, we want to give storytellers those tools that get all the technical stuff out of the way and allow them to just concentrate on telling really good stories and using those tools to do it in new ways as well.
But 2010 would have been very early. Like, even the last couple of years, people are still like going video. It's only starting. I was only talking to people about podcasts this week and how they're growing, you know, exponentially. Yeah. And it's a large part of it is high speed internet on your phone, because no one has time or the inclination that before you go walk the dog, you have to download it on your Wi-Fi and then you can go out and listen and stream to it. Like, I remember 2010, 2011, like painful trying to watch a video on your phone. Like, so how did you guys know and have the confidence that it was going to be so big?
We just believed that it was an idea worth pursuing, you know, and we believed that it would eventually happen. We didn't know when. Mm. And, you know, we were very early. And actually, we were very early and we remained small for a few years because we were very early. We didn't kind of start building our team really until 2013, 2014.
Okay. You know, so what happened in 2010? Was Dara working with you in Satanta, or how did the whole team come together?
No. So we had worked together before in a previous company of his. So this is his third startup.
Okay.
Or third business. We started anymore. Probably are. So he had Nebula Technologies. And I worked there. So we knew each other from there.
Okay.
And then he had another company called Wild Wave. with another person from Nebula Technologies. And Nebula, they'd grown to like 120 people. They were doing websites. It was around the .com time, you know. That whole industry was, the bubble popped in it, but they did reasonably well out of it and, you know, created a lot of like little teams of people who went on to create their own companies, you know. So it's very, very interesting to see that sort of, the layers within the Dublin startup system today that go back to people who work together on teams and companies that were started.
It's fascinating. It's like there's a network of good people, like because good people attract more good people, and then they just keep going together, and just that goes on to follow another company, and then they start something else. It's so interesting. And I think the ecosystem is now kind of established enough that there's people who started back with you, say 2010, 28, 29, that now have started their second or third company. And I think that's when interesting things start to happen.
Yeah, so I mean, it's very, very interesting when you look at the mapping of all of that, just people mapping. But so we just had this vision that was going to happen at some point. And the big thing that happened for us was with TV3 at the time, and Virgin Media, they're still a customer of ours. But we did a project with them called ShowPal. I don't know if you remember it, but it was...
That's ringing a bell.
Yeah, it was this companion app that was for all of their primetime shows. So we used audio content recognition technology so that your device would listen to the TV signal. So the TV signal landed in your living room, your device picked it up and it could tell where you were in the program. Oh. So then it could show you stuff based on what you were watching.
Oh, like a very advanced
time in which you were watching it. Yeah. It was super cool. So we did like companion experiences for Expose, Champions League, Vincent Brown, all of these different shows. And it was an enormous learning experience for us as to what worked with different genres and, you know, what didn't work, what did work.
How did you get started though? Even that technology sounds extremely advanced. So how did you, you know, day one, I think that's what a lot of people want to know, like day one, what did you guys do? Did you get together and go, right, we need to hire a developer? Did you guys have tech skills? How did it happen?
So Dara was the tech person in the company that he had built before. So that, like, I already had a really experienced technology founder and I knew the market. So, you know, those two things combined were very, very good. Mm-hmm. And we started working with developing with other developers that we knew, and we'd hired when we needed to. And we were a services company for a number of years and really building, we were starting to find that we were building the same thing.
You know, so clients would ask you to build something like ShowPal, you'd build it, it'd be kind of like a one-off thing, but you guys weren't owning the kind of technology, or what way did it work?
It wasn't that, it was like there's two elements to it. There was the back-end system and then there was the front-end apps. And we were doing both, but they were sort of separate. And then we were like, you know, we could just make a product that would just power all of these front-end apps. And then we could just, you know, repeat these apps into something that's also a product. So it links up into one thing so that people sign up to us and they get the content management side of it, but they also get the app.
You're not starting from scratch every single time redesigning.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then we were like, that's a product. You know, so we actually had to do that leap from being a services company to being a product company. And we did it in not that long ago. So it was like really 2017.
Right. Okay. So that's relatively new. Okay. I think that's what catches people out is people have great ideas for like big ideas, you know, like big ideas like you guys. And they struggle to make that leap from, I don't know how to get from where I am today, day one with this idea, to something that's massive. So I think that explanation of how you started a service company is important for people to kind of follow that journey. So you did that for a number of years to kind of learn and also, I guess, pay yourselves.
Yeah, we funded it through that. And, you know, that was a good way of figuring out what the market actually needed, and, you know, who our target customers were, what they actually wanted, what they were willing to spend, you know, all of that thing that you kind of figure out. But like, because we were a little bit early to market, we got the jump on it a bit, but then we got like, suddenly there were other competitors in the market as well. So you're like, ah, okay. But building a product or moving from being a services company to being a product company is way, way more than just building something and selling it as a product. Like, it's a completely different type of company that you're building. So that's like a big mind shift that everyone has to go through. You have to think product first and everything, right? So we put a strategy in place that was, we are going all in on product. We want to be a product first company. Because we were somewhere between the two for like a little while, and that was hard.
That's my question. I was going to ask you, how do you shift? How do you not like throw the baby out with the bathwater? How do you kind of like make sure you still have money coming in to pay everybody, but also the focus going this way as well? How do you find that?
What we did was we applied for the Horizon 2020 SME instrument, and we got funding that way to do it.
What was that?
What was the funding round, or what was the
Horizon 2020?
It's a grant. It's a grant called Horizon 2020 SME Instrument. It's renamed something now. It might be European Innovation Council or something like that. And it is available to European companies. It's about two things: innovation and impact. If you have something innovative and you're doing something that will have an impact on either society or raising or employment in Europe, that's really what that job is for. It's to give you a bit of rocket fuel to get you further along. So we took that grant money and built a product and assembled a more product oriented structure to our company. And that is not an easy shift. It is not an easy shift at all. It takes a while, you know? So now we are a product company.
What was the issues? What were the issues between kind of shifting between the two? What were the biggest problems you found?
It's not that there were problems. It was more that there is just different thinking. You know, when you're thinking about coding something for somebody that you can't talk to on Slack, for example, or whether you're, you know, marketing something in a very, like, so we would have done our sales and services in a very face-to-face, founder-led, event-driven way. And then, you know, you have to change to, okay, landing pages for the different types of verticals that we have, you know, what works, what doesn't, lots of experiments, lots of very metric-driven things. So, you know, there's just, and the, how you would structure your teams and your process, kind of, you know, we had to really separate out who was doing what and be very clear about that. That organization takes a very long time, you know, and everybody has to be on board and everybody has to change behaviors. And if there's one thing I've learned about culture in a company and behaviors, like, that's getting the right behaviors that actually support your strategy is the thing that makes you scale.
Interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's something that people don't necessarily get, but when they get it, it's like a big aha moment. And that aha moment for me, I was on, I did a bit of executive education last year with on a program called Leadership for Growth, which Enterprise Ireland does every year for 30 Irish founders from lots of different sectors. And I it was one of the things that I took away from that. We did it with EAZ Business School in Spain, which was nice.
Okay, not a bad place to be going to.
And yeah, it was lovely. It was in Barcelona. I love Barcelona.
Oh, it's a beautiful
city. And we also did a bit in New York, which I was always in New York anyway, because that's a lot of our customers are in the US. But it was mind-opening just to say, oh, you know what? Culture isn't just about, you know, like every, it's not just about having the company's personality and understanding what that is. And, you know, every single company will have a culture and it'll be led by the behaviors that you set, that you value and that you say you value in. And that comes from founders down, you know, or across, or, you know, it's kind of like, these are the things that we value. And whether you're consciously or unconsciously doing that, it's there, but you have an opportunity to shape it into something that are like, you know, the behaviors that if everyone did them, they would actually just make the company move faster and faster and grow faster. So that, those things, knowing what they are, knowing which ones to reward and which ones to keep, you know, moving forward, really aligning that with your actual strategy of what you want the company to do, what the company wants to do, is rocket fuel. Like, that's a huge takeaway for me.
And when you had that moment, It's a very broad question. So how do you shift? Did you have to shift the culture, or did you, as you said there, you said something really interesting, rewarding a certain type of behavior.
Yeah.
How did you kind of come back and start tweaking things? Because I think people talk about culture a lot. Culture is one of those buzzwords that's thrown around by a lot of American multinationals.
Oh, yeah.
You know, oh, culture, 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 junk, culture, culture, culture. You know, LinkedIn is literally verbal vomit of culture. But I do believe you're exactly on the money there in terms of it's much deeper than just having your spirit animal. It's something that's very ingrained. So how did you change your thinking on that?
So any company really does is just sit down and say, well, what do we value? And as a leadership team, what are the traits in people that we know on our team that if everyone did those things, that we would deliver more on? And then, you know, when you describe the behaviors and you come out and you approach it from behaviors, you then sort of figure out, like, you can group those behaviors together and then find out, well, actually, these are the things that we value.
Yeah.
I think Stripes does a really good job of explaining, and it's almost like this is how our company works. It's describing that in terms of behaviors and intention behind them. And if you do that in a very clear way, then you attract people who like doing those things.
Yes, very true. No, it sounds so simple, but it's very true. Yeah, when you put it up on the board and have transparency, and this is what we like, this is what we don't like. Get on board.
And then you have less of those kind of weird conversations where it's like, oh, this, you know, and people worry about being a culture fit or not a culture fit. And, you know, it's not about hiring lots of people who are exactly like you.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Yeah, I think that's the mistake people make. People, they have to have my sense of values, you know, and everything has to fit together. And God forbid we'd have an argument, you know?
Yeah, no. The argument and debate is good and healthy. Especially when it's robust and the company is at the center of it. And it's like, this is the best for the company. And then if you're all pointing that way, then that works. So, you know, having behaviors that are clear and rewarding those behaviors and calling people out who are good examples of them, that breeds alignment. And then alignment makes everything just so much easier.
You make it sound so simple.
And here's, the thing is, though, simplification and just making things super simple is the goal. But I wouldn't discount how much hard work goes into making things simple.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a sign of true intelligence. I think you can make complex simple. I had Glenn from the Startup Accountant on a few weeks ago, and his episode got just such fantastic feedback because he made something which is quite complex, accounting and, you know, finance and grants and cash flow. And he just broke it down to just, this is what you need to do. This is what it is. Off you go. And people loved it. People literally, I got so many messages from people going, thank you. That was just, I've read it 10 times and I just can't get my head around the grant system or, you know, the COVID-19 payments. And, you know, it really is a sign of a truly, truly intelligent person that can make something complex very simple.
Yeah. But it really requires a lot of work and iteration to get it there.
So how did you then, you're now a product company, you're making that transition. You know, you talked about there about moving from kind of face-to-face, you know, founder conversations. Wow. This is Claire. We like Claire. You know, she's done great work with us before. Mm. How did you talked about leaving clients in New York and places like that. Before 2016, 17, were you mainly Irish-based or Europe-based, or what way did it work?
No, we were like, in terms of where our team was, yes.
But no, where your clients were?
Our clients were, we've always had US customers.
Okay.
Like from day one, actually, which has been great because our network is good there too.
Okay.
And that, we find that even with the target customers that we have, especially in the media space, their global HQ could be in New York or they're in LA. So like, even if we are dealing with people in different countries around the world, on teams, decisions are made in the US.
Okay.
You know, for some of these things. So
So from the very start, you worked with US companies. I think that's something that's important to note for people as well, who are building something that just isn't for Ireland, especially now whereby, you know, Ireland mightn't sustain you anymore. You know, there might be a recession, you know, there might be a country that takes off quicker than others. So how did you guys target the US straight away? Like, how did you make that leap from, you know, Claire in Dublin to like working with heads of like companies in New York?
At the time, we knew that Ireland wasn't going to sustain us as a market because of the big budgets required to do new and innovative things in media that weren't done before. And that was kind of the thing that we were going for. So we went for innovation budgets, for, you know, R&D innovation budgets, where people who, or companies that would have their own development teams, but just wouldn't necessarily have the time to try new stuff out. Like they were doing their mission critical stuff and they had a lot of work to do in their pipeline. We would meet up with the people running the R&D and innovation budgets and do work for them. Okay. And that would be lots of things that never even made it to the hands of consumers for very big companies, but that were learning opportunities for us to A, take revenue from, but also learn a lot about. They were big media companies as well. So like, we did a lot of stuff. Dara had a very good network already in New York because he lived there for a few years.
Okay, interesting.
So, you know, we were able to tap into that. We were able to tap into my network. We were able to, like, you know, went back and forth quite a bit. I used to spend a lot of time in New York. And so with Dara, and actually LA is another place that we spend more and more time now as well.
Sounds like a tough setup, Claire. Sounds like a really well,
when you're on a plane,
LA, New York, Barcelona. Yeah, I'm really feeling for you.
Barcelona
here.
Was fantastic.
It's a gorgeous city. Just on something, I think you've like let out a great hack there about, you know, who's your customer, what company, but where in the company are they? I think that's what people don't really think about. You've said they're, you know, innovation departments. That's where they had the money to do big, big things. Mm. Like that's really, really important. How did you guys know that or stumble across that or target those people?
Well, it was just a good, like, timing was good. The recession was kind of starting, you know, it was 2010. So what happens in recessions, innovation budgets disappear, right? But then people start to go, well, what else can we do? And how do we address big technological shifts that are coming along? So like, for example, right now, we see the barriers to video coming way down. People who wouldn't have been comfortable with video before, or like their comfort is there now. Do you know what I mean? So that's a behavioral shift, I think, that will stay long-term. And it's across companies as well as individual consumers. But you kind of just have to look for the people who are going to the conferences that are about those topics. So if it's VR, go, you know, find people who are speaking at or going to events around VR, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Or they will have titles like advanced technologist or, you know, like it's interesting. And you just build relationships with those people.
Yeah.
Like it's harder to do it in a world like this where you're not sitting in a bar with them or you're not like hanging out randomly just having a chat because you're sitting down beside them. So it's kind of there's definitely some new thoughts to be going into how people actually do make connections going forward, but it's finding the right people who are thinking about it, and it might be two years away from them actually doing anything about it.
Okay. I think it's interesting because I think people start, you know, they develop a great idea. And, you know, they get their first MVP up and then they just get so frustrated because they're getting no's or getting no reactions. So, yeah, I think that's a really smart one is look at all the conferences and look who's speaking and look who's attending. Mm. And, you know, you kind of have to put in the groundwork. You mentioned something there that I actually want to chat about is in a recession. So I won't jinx things by talking about the future, but, you know, if we are facing a period of downturn, we'll call it that. It sounds a little bit less painful. What did you guys do in, you know, you started 2010, so it was the depths of it, really.
Yeah, it was.
So what did you guys do that kind of helped you? Well, you survived, obviously, and grew during that time. So what did you do?
Well, we stayed small enough as we needed to be. You know, we didn't grow too aggressively at the start, really trying to figure out, was there something there? But the good things around, like, I think recession or downturns or, you know, weird global events are great times for creativity. They, you know, you get a lot of talented people who are looking to do something new. Maybe they're trying to change industry, or they realize that, you know, they don't really like doing what they're doing, and this is a time, good a time as any to do something new. Probably find a lot of people setting up their own businesses, right? Because it might be that little push that gets them to go, you know what, life is finite, and why don't I try this thing? And also, office space will be cheap. I think after this particular place where everyone is used to working from their house, you know, I think that probably is a consequence that we might see. There's a lot more creativity around. People think slightly differently. They're trying to join dots in ways that they maybe hadn't considered before. So I think there's I think the atmosphere is quite a creative one, and quite a good one for entrepreneurs kicking off. It's harder when you're at a point where everything's been building up, and your expectation of where you are now is off where it should be. And that is hard, but it's looking at your resources. It's kind of going, okay, what do I have? How can I protect this? How can I make it stretch? Who do I know that I can talk to? And one thing about this downturn now is that people are being super, super helpful, because I think everyone wants the economy to recover as quickly as possible, right? So you will find people very willing to share their expertise, their stories, even on Twitter, it's funny, sharing some tips on how to get through this. As you mentioned, sharing how to actually apply for the fundings and grants that are available. It's talk to people, you know, talk to people, ask them, hey, how did you do that?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Know? Well, that's how we connected. I saw you, someone I know commented, or you commented on someone I know on LinkedIn, and you were offering to chat to people and give advice. I think that's the power of that is just so big, you know, so big, because you can sit at home on your own Googling for weeks and kind of going, I wonder what the answer is to that. I wonder who I need to talk to. But as you say, get on Twitter, get on LinkedIn, and people are there offering, seasoned entrepreneurs like yourself are there offering to go, yeah, I'll chat to you about that and tell you. it's like a shortcut. It's like doing a degree in a couple of minutes. You know, you just get straight through everything and go, well, that's what we did. And that's why I like to ask very specific questions to people like yourselves, going, you know, how did you get through that time, or how did you transition from service to product? Because they're the kind of practical things that people can now apply. I agree with you 100%, everything you said there. I think the next year, 2 years will be a time of unbelievable innovation in startups. I think people will suddenly go exactly what you said, going, I don't think what I was doing before. I saw Pat Phelan put up a poll on his Instagram, and he was like, will you go back to the life you had before? And I think 61% of people said no. That blew my mind. And I was like, that's really, really powerful.
That's a very broad question.
Very true. Very true. No, I want a pizza every day for lunch. I think, yeah, we might need to refine it. But I think it's true. I think what you say there about people suddenly going, this is like a big reset button. This is like a chance. You know, what have I been doing for the last 5 years? Oh, I never really liked that job anyway. Grand. Okay. Unfortunately, they might get laid off, or unfortunately, the company might go in a different way. Yes. I think there will be a huge... And to be fair, I think that the grants and stuff that have been made available, and the COVID payments that have been made available, will help people, you know, for the next 3 to 6 months get started.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even just to refocus. And, you know, talking to somebody else who has the experience of also being a founder, or, you know, a leader in business that has gone through multiple years. And if they are doing it for multiple years, they will have gone through loads and loads of stuff, and they will have made loads and loads of mistakes they could tell you not to make, or show you not to make them the same way they did. But also, they, you know, it's an objective view that isn't it's very easy to get introspective, and your mind fills in the blanks in a way that tells the story that you're telling yourself, right? Yes. So getting somebody outside is objective. And actually, even having to talk to them in the first place means that you will do a bit more homework, a bit more prep, and get to understand your business in a more, because you will have to tell them about it. You suddenly have to articulate your problems, and you have to actually know what your issues actually are, which makes you focus. And I think that's a really that's the gift. It's kind of like that objective. Hey, you know what? You're not doing that bad. here's some stuff that you could try, or here's how I got on with that particular issue.
You've touched on some really powerful there that we talked about previously, was asking the right question or asking a good question. And we talked about it off air briefly before, in terms of if you are asking someone for advice, you know, put your homework in. So when people come to you for advice, what's a good way of being prepared? Like, you know, how can they come to you and get the most value? Because your time is valuable. You know, how do people get the most value out of asking an expert or an entrepreneur for advice?
Think about their issues and find out what the actual issue is. Like, really think about it. You know, everyone has issues and they're all different. But like, if you can ask somebody about something, just be very specific about what it is that you're asking them about. And the context, give them context in which to ask the question, because that always helps. You know, so it's like a little bit of background on, and not enormous amounts of information about your business, like that's not helpful. It's actually just really specific context to the thing that you want to know more about. And they can ask questions then to help them tease it out a bit more. And actually the answers to those questions will probably be very revealing. But yeah, just like, I'd like a chat is not really, you know, why?
You know, about sports, COVID, what particularly do you want to talk about?
Actually, sometimes people just want to vent. And if they don't have a hole to scream into, and, you know, if everyone's living in their houses at the moment, there's not those many holes available to scream into, you know, just going to somebody, hey, I'm having all these issues. And they go, oh, me too. Like that. That's sometimes true. Can be very, very helpful as well, because, you know, like if you're a sole founder, even if you're on like two or three people on a team founding company, and having to be a leader and having to guide people through this, it can be a very lonely experience. It can be a hard, tough experience where you have to be all this positive stuff on the outside, but inside you're going, shit, I don't know what to do. And, you know, we were mentioning this before, like you have a whole bunch of different stakeholders that you need to present to and not crumble up in front of. So you kind of need the odd person that you can share that that experience with, where you're both crumbling a little bit.
Yeah.
So peer-to-peer stuff is really, really, really important.
And that's what I tell a lot of people who kind of are like, oh, you know, what should I be doing? You know, I'm like, you should be having a group of people around you that can... don't have to be in your industry, preferably not. They can just be in any industry, just doing their own. I have a group that I meet every month. Well, we don't meet anymore. We're having a Zoom this week. But just all different industries, just on entrepreneurs. And we just sit down and talk, and we all bring a problem or bring something we want to discuss. Very specific, one line. Yeah. This is what I'm working on. This is actually a great idea. This is what I've tried already.
Yeah.
And this is what I would like to achieve. And three sentences, and you sit back, you don't sit out of the group, but you sit back and you let them talk as if you're not there. And it's unbelievably powerful. I'd never done it before. It's unbelievably powerful, because then you're not butting in with all that. Oh, well, I think, you know, you just get a completely outside perspective. So how have you over the years grown up at kind of that network? Where have you built that from, or what work have you done to kind of cultivate that?
I would naturally cultivate that anyway. And I'm a big believer in having a wide network and sourcing opinions from lots of people. I'm probably more likely to consult widely before I I mightn't just make a decision in a vacuum. Like a lot of people are really like very decisive, bum, bum, bum. Once I make a decision, I stick to it, but like I will think around it first. And it's just the way my brain works. So I'll talk to people about things. I'll also just like, you know, if I want to get a message out there, I'll tell a bunch of people. And that, you know, it's not like I'm not like I am building a network. It's kind of like just relationships. It's just relationship building. So you need to tend those relationships and nurture them. And it's not always about having every conversation be very business driven and specific to that. It's just about shared experiences. It's about having, like the chats that we were having before we started recording this, like it's that kind of just getting to know people and understand them. And then, you know, when you have something that you think that they can help with, ask them. You know, people really like being asked for help when they know that they can help.
And it's not just a transactional thing whereby I've connected with you on LinkedIn. Hey, have you considered this solution? Don't do that.
No, that's terrible.
Don't be that guy. I'm the same. I think it's I hate networking events because they make me sick. Just that sort of transparency of like people still think they're a good idea. I don't understand, you know, why people still think that, you know, going to something with the explicit intention of just hard selling to people, like it's just so inefficient. I 100% believe what you're doing about relationships over time.
But how do you feel about community?
That's everything. Like a community of people around you over 10 years, not going to some crappy event for free pizza and beer and like getting pitched for 10 solid minutes on repeat. I think you have to invest the time. If you're going to these events thinking, oh yeah, suddenly you're going to find the magic bullet here, you're in for a long time, because I think you have to build a solid community of people around you, people you like, people who like you, people who you've provided value to over a long time, more like friends than just, you know, transactional networking. You know, I just think it's a bonkers way to approach it. I think it's a long-term game. Like you guys are in business 10 years, you know, that's kind of a testament of what you guys have been doing. So for entrepreneurs that are maybe potentially thinking about starting up now, what would be kind of your key structure? So you're starting again from day one. What would be the things that you would do first?
Wow. Well, talk about your idea. Talk about it to as many people as possible. Some people kind of think that I have this idea. It's really good. No one's done it, so I better not tell anyone about it. Self mode. That's a load of shite. I think it's kind of like, you know, why are you in self mode? Like,
it's already been done. It's already been done. Don't worry about it. It's how you execute.
Exactly. And how hard you work at it. So, you know, it's kind of like, if you have this idea, someone else has thought of it, for sure. And it doesn't matter. But the more people you tell about it, the more real it becomes. Mm-hmm. And the more people you told about it, then Jay-Z probably have to do it.
That's true. Yeah.
But the more objective feedback you'll get from people, or, you know, you might tell them your idea and your idea comes out of your mouth one way and lands into their ears in a completely different way. And then they like, I don't think I understand that idea. So you're actually getting to refine it by just having to tell people about it.
That's brilliant, because they can get someone to repeat your idea back to you is a great one, because you're like, that's not it at all. No. I'm clearly not explaining this completely at all.
Exactly. And it's super, super hard. And I always think this is like the hardest thing. It's like writing your own business plan, writing your own CV, writing, you know, anything that's like you're so personally attached to.
Yeah. And that's tough.
It's super difficult. Yeah.
That's you, because you feel a bit
write
naked.
It down for you.
Yeah, you feel a bit naked when you're pitching it to people going, oh, this is so deeply personal. You know, if they don't like it, do they not like me? Yeah. So I think that's, I think that's brilliant though. It's just as many people as possible, not just your mates, not just your mom, you know, as many people as you can talk to, and people, it comes back to our earlier point about building a community and building a valuable network of people. You know, people you trust, people you respect, people who've been
people
there.
People who'll be honest to you and say, you know what? I don't like your idea. I don't like it, you know, and that's fine. And, or also the other thing I would say is figure out what problem you're actually trying to solve. I think that's the key thing as well. And who might actually buy the thing that you want to sell? And, you know, is it actually a pain point for them? Mm. You know, and if it is, how high on the register of pain points is it? Like, you know, it might be, that's the thing I'd really like to do someday over here. That might be a long sales cycle, or it could be this thing is really killing me. And if I just had a way to fix it, I'd have so much more time on my hands.
Yeah.
Like understanding how the thing that you're doing actually creates value for the other person.
the scale on the pain point is brilliant. I heard someone talk about that a few weeks ago. I think it was in relation to COVID, and it was like, you know, exactly, almost word for what you said there in terms of, you know, is it a 1 or 10? You know, is this like red light going off? The place is on fire. This is urgent. We need to figure this out. It's like, you know, like we talked about there about restaurants. Okay, a massive pain point. I have to get reopened. How do I do that? How do I get delivery system going? How do I get an app? How do I order online? Mm. You know, that's the kind of stuff. And I think there's going to be monster opportunity for people in the next couple
that
of years.
Actually, that pain point sort of sliding scale thing, I think it's from a book called The Mom Test. I can't remember who wrote it, but it's a tiny little book. You know, it's got a weird name, but it's about like validating your idea. Mm. And like, you know, you could tell your mother about the idea and she'll say, oh, that's great. Well, you know, depends on your mom. But, you know, you say it to somebody else and they'd be like, that's a terrible idea. Or, you know, it's how to ask those questions. And you were talking about asking questions. I think that's a good book on how to ask the right questions.
Okay.
Especially just in the sphere of validating customers.
Mm. Well, actually, the last question I have for you is to recommend a book. So you can think about that just for a minute.
I have three.
Oh,
like I have them here.
You've done your homework. I'm delighted. That's why I always preload it for people. I always say, now I'm just about to come to the last question with the book, just in case they go completely blank. But just to go back, we'll come back, jump back one more step. You were talking about the first steps and, you know, once they've got the kind of idea and they've kind of validated it a little bit, how would you get them to kind of the first sale? You know, because what I want the podcast to be is a very practical resource whereby people can listen and go, Claire's story is class. And I also understand now what I wasn't doing or what I need to be doing. So from that kind of idea stage, going, oh yeah, I think this is good. Yeah, I know, you know what? I'm going to put rubber to road now here. We're going to go for it.
Yeah.
How did they get from that idea to the first sale?
First sale is kind of probably quite far. Like that's not a step one, step two at all. What you need to do is write it down. Yeah. After you've told everybody, you write it down. And write it down in a way that is like a one page, what is your business doing? And then show that to a few people as well. Mm. And also the next thing is to sort of mock it up, draw it, like draw the experience, draw the thing that's in your head. Mm. You know, and it is kind of sort of the building blocks of putting together some kind of pitch. But if you want to go like, even you don't have to spend it, even if it's technology, and I know technology is expensive, right? So you really need to be pretty damn sure before you go all in on spending things that your thing is a reasonable estimation. And it's only really by getting an MVP or a minimum viable product out the door that you can assess that. So, you know, that MVP could be something that is a spreadsheet. It could be something that is a series of connected tools that in some way produce the result that you're trying to achieve. It could be a really nice designed layout of something. It could be a video. You know, there's a ton of ways of doing something before you actually go and test it out. And then test it out after that to a bunch of people that are in your target market who you don't really want to sell to, but test, validate a few things, validate like the pricing, that kind of thing. You know, here's what I'm thinking. How about, you know, what would you think about these? Or tell them the business model that you're thinking and, you know, tell somebody else a different business model and see, you know.
I like that. Get them, I like that.
You know, yeah, like just try it to see what the reactions you get are to those things and then sort of piece it together into this is the thing that we think will work. And then, you know, some landing pages about, here's the thing, are you interested in it? And like spend some money on some Google AdWords and SEO and you know, sort of really try and see, is there legs to this thing? Then you can get to getting towards your first sale.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that. I think that's where the name came from, the Entrepreneur Experiment. Big fan of just test, because better off to do a test, as you say, maybe get 200-300 quid's worth of AdWords, plow into it and see. And then go, that's not, but this weird thing happened when we were doing it. And that's actually where we need to go. Claire, that was brilliant advice. Super. What? I'm excited. Yeah. What three books? I'm actually going to order books off Amazon today, so I might grab one of these. What three books do you recommend? Mm. You have them in everything. It's like okay. You're super prepared.
I do. So this one is Thanks for the Feedback.
Okay.
And that's The Science and Art of Receiving Feedback Well, Even When It's Off-Base, Unfair, Poorly Delivered, and Frankly, You're Not in the Mood. That's the full title.
Super specific. Very relevant to what we're just talking about. Yeah, great.
It's actually a cool book cover, and I will give it kudos for being an excellent book cover. It's also an excellent book. Douglas Stone and Sheila Heen.
Brilliant.
And
it is about feedback. Okay.
It's about receiving feedback well, because everyone's like, feedback, but that's the thing that you give. No, it's also a two-way thing. Mm. So, you know, giving and receiving it, and, you know, looking at it objectively. It's like, even if someone's giving you feedback and it's annoying and it feels like criticism, and, you know, there's emotion, and the person who's delivering it to you is somebody that you have a relationship with, you're adding back to it. You know, the whole ton of stuff. To be honest, I don't know how people actually talk to each other. After reading this book, I'm like, really? There's no way it's like humanly possible for the thoughts that are in somebody's head to get out and get received properly by the other person. You know, it's very interesting. Okay. So I would recommend
it. First time that came up, actually. Yeah, that's really good.
Okay. I've also got this one, The Messy Middle.
Ah, yes, I've heard about this. Is it good?
By Scott Belsky. Now, it's a collection of blog posts, but they are really like...
Oh, clever.
Interesting blog posts. And so you can dip in and out of it.
I like that. It's kind of like books,
The hard thing about hard things, because you dip in and out of, you know, if you have a problem, you're like, I have this problem.
Yeah, I like that though. I like those kind of reference books where you're kind of like, I wonder, is there a specific answer here? I like that.
But there's one in here, like they all have different... I was reading this and going, oh yeah, I've done that. Oh, I made that mistake. Oh yeah, I did that. You know,
life story.
There is a very one here that it's like, you are not your work. Mm. And I think that's a really important thing. It took me a long time to learn that lesson. Mm. You are not your company. You are not your work. Because I think you can, as a founder, really get lost in that, especially when it's a long journey. You can kind of lose the boundaries between what you and what
absolutely
the company, and that you can attach. Well, it's on the floor. You can attach the success of one to the other, and you know you have to really learn to separate and look at things objectively. Now, this is the last one.
Traction. Okay.
Traction is actually, like, it's not a thrilling book to read, but it is a. It's a really good framework for running a business. It's the Entrepreneurial Operating System.
Oh, cool. I like this. I haven't heard of that one either.
It's cool because it really just breaks things down into very easily translatable things. So it's like, what's your vision? What's your core focus? What's your core niche? What's your 10-year target?
Oh,
what's your three-year picture? What's your one-year plan? And you break that down to quarterly rocks, as they call them. So they're kind of goals. And then issues. And
that's cool.
Then it has all these, there's like really good tools for analyzing parts of your business. We're actually rolling it out at the moment. Really? I know another company, a couple of companies that have rolled it out successfully. They love it.
I haven't actually come across it yet. Traction. I'm actually going to grab that.
Yeah,
one
it's like
brilliant.
EOS is the framework, but it's something that just brings vision into a very practical, hands-on thing that everyone can get involved in. Mm. So it's almost like an operating manual to running your company.
You need that though. I think at the start, you're all over the shop and you're doing it, and that's how we're doing it. We're getting it done. It gets to a point. Yeah. I think when you get your first couple of employees, that's the point whereby you really need to have, and the earlier you do it, the better, because.
Yeah. I wouldn't do it too early. Yeah. I think you need to get to a certain size for this, but read it. Yeah. Mm. Read it first and then figure it out. There's definitely tools that you can use, like the people analyzer stuff. You can use that before, like while you're starting to do your first hires, and even just to do it for yourself. Mm. But like, it does make sense for larger teams, because
that's
then,
cool.
You know, it splits things into, you know, data, vision, people, process. Mm. And it's kind of like, it breaks your business down into very easy manageable chunks. That's why I like it.
Super. Great. Listen, for people to win that, all they have to do is tag us on social media. Just share the episode and tag us on social media and they can win a copy of that book.
Awesome.
Brilliant.
I would love more copies of that book in Ireland.
Brilliant. We'll try promote that this week. Claire, thank you so much for taking time to chat.
You're very welcome, Gary.
Enjoy your weekend.
Yeah. You too. Take care.
And that was episode 50. Again, thank you for listening. And thank you for listening if you've been listening all the way through our journey. We're only getting going, so this is just the start. If you want to win one of the books that Claire talked about, simply share this episode and tag myself, Mr. Gary Fox, and Claire on social media channels, any of your choice. Just make sure to tag us or you cannot win. I will see you next Thursday at 6 a.m. Until then, have a great and safe week.